Okay, welcome to Got Invention Radio. I'm your host, Brian Freed. Tonight is May 17th, 2012, and we have Anthony Knight. He is the director of the Office of Petitions for the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and he's joining us on our show tonight to give us updates on the America Invents Act, just general information about patents, trademarks, copyrights, all those things that we want to know about. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for inviting me onto the show.
Absolutely.
I've got lots of information to talk about, and I'd like to just try to say I'm very grateful that you invited me on the show.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate having you and you taking your time out and helping the independent inventors out there listening, resources for inventors listening. We have all different types of people out there, and we definitely appreciate the information that I know we're going to be speaking about tonight. So if you don't mind, let's start off with kind of the basics. First off, there's a lot of inventors out there that are confused with or just don't have the full information about what a provisional patent is, what a non-provisional patent application is, design patents, copyrights, trademarks, all that kind of stuff. Maybe you can just kind of walk us through, maybe start off with what a provisional patent application. You know what? Before we even do that, what is intellectual property? How about that?
Okay. A little intellectual property is just any of these properties that come from your mind, that you create from your mind, and that you're able to record in some way, or that you can use to create a business or create some way of and showing, and the property is, it would be some way that you can show it that it's yours. And let's go in and just talk about just the general types of intellectual property. I mean, we've got patents, we've got trademarks, we got copyrights, we got trade secrets. And when you look at patents, and that's the area that I'm in the patent area. We have the utility patents and we have the design patents. Some plant patents, but I don't think we're going to go into plant patents so much because there are very few people that file plant patents. Okay. Majority of people are filing design and utility applications. And just to say what the design application is, it's just an application that covers the look and feel or the look and appearance of a particular device. It's like a just covering the ornamental structure of the device. And there's no function that's claimed in a design patent. It's just the drawings themselves. And you would think that, you know, with a design patent, it's really not going to be worth all that much money. But I can remember reading one of these cases years ago, and it was for a windsock. And that's a device that's used at airports, you know, that they can tell which direction the wind is blowing in. And these windsocks, they had like a fish on them or a bird or something like that. And it had some sort of a dish on it to show, you know, just the picture. And when you read the case, you find out the guy had actually licensed this particular invention for $100,000. So that shows you that design patents can actually be worth quite a bit of money. But you're only looking at just the look and the appearance of the device.
Got it.
Now, when you get to the utility patents, you're actually talking about the structure and the function of the device or how it operates. So it might be, you know, maybe you're talking about washing cars, and so it's the method by which the car gets washed, or it could be the soap, which would be the composition, or it could be the brushes themselves, which would do the actual washing. So there's all different things that could be part of a utility application or utility patent.
Okay, and a utility patent, another word for utility patent, is also a non-provisional patent, right?
Well, it would be provisional or non-provisional.
Right.
Okay.
And now,
when you get to the provisional applications, those applications are filed. There's no examination that's done for the applications. It's a modest fee that's paid for the provisional application. And what it does is it gives you a way of showing that you created that invention on that particular date. 1 year after you file that provisional application, you have to come back in and file a non-provisional application. Because 1 year from the date at which that provisional application is filed, it will expire, and we're not going to let you continue that application. What you could do is file a new provisional application, but you start over at that date there.
Okay, understood. Actually, if you don't mind, Tony, There's a question that came in that's specifically for
Sure.
this. The Carrie sends a message, and she says, I have a question about provisional patents. Some attorneys tell me that the invention becomes public domain if you do not continue the process after a year. Others tell me you can continue with a gap in time. What's the truth?
Those applications are held in confidence. We do not publish the provisional applications. So the fact that you may have one and it's filed and you don't do anything with it, it's not going to become, it's not going to be dedicated to the public within 1 year.
Okay.
But if you want to file that non-provisional application and claim priority to your provisional application.
Okay.
Because the non-provisional application is the one that gets examined, and it's the one in which you get some rights that go with along with it once the patent issues.
Got it.
Now, if you don't get a patent that issues, you're not going to have any rights. So as long as the application is pending in the U.S., you can mark your goods as patent pending, you can mark your process as patent pending, but you can't go into court and sue anybody.
Okay, thank you for that.
You have a right to be able to sue people.
Got it.
Okay.
Listeners out there, if you'd like, you can email me your questions, brian@gotinvention.com, and I'll be happy to pass the message to Tony to be able to answer for you live on the show right now. So keep the emails coming in. Thank you for your question, Carrie. All right. So what's the next step? You want to talk about trademarks?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about trademarks too. And trademarks really are a way of indicating where the goods or services come from. So if you have, say, something like the NBC Peacock or the NBC Sound, you know that when you're watching TV, that you're watching. And if you have something, you know, you can have something where it just is a color, which might indicate where the goods are coming from, you know, what the pink stands for when you look at fire insulation, and you know where that fiber, you know, insulation is coming from. Or you can have a word or phrase that would describe what the goods are. Now, one of the things is that you can be very successful with this trademark in indicating where the goods are coming from. And if you get to be too successful, that trademark may be considered generic, since it may wind up being called this thing for other products that are out there. And I don't want to go into saying what some of these terms might be considered generic for, you know, because I don't want to ruin anybody's rights.
Okay.
Okay?
That sounds
good. And then we have copyrights. And copyrights are for the artistic expression that you make. You're writing a book, you type the words down on the page, or if you had a song, you'd record that on a CD or record it on your computer. And as soon as you're done doing the act of recording it, you have your... And I can remember talking to one little kid at one of the events I was at recently, and what their mother told me is that they were copywriting all of the work that they sent into their teacher, and they didn't want the teachers to take their work from them. And what I had to explain to them is they really didn't have to go through the act of marking everything as copyrighted that they sent to the teacher, because as soon as they put their words down on the page, they have a copyright. Okay, so it covers the expression that you have on that particular work. And
how long are each of the terms for the provisional patent, the non-provisional, otherwise known as utility patent, and design patent?
Okay.
If you can help us with that.
And the lifetime for the patent is, for the utility patents, it is 20 years from the effective filing date of the application. So if you file an application 20 years later, once the patent issues, you're going to have your patent's going to expire. And whenever if you have a design application, it's 14 years from the issue date of that design patent. Trademarks are beautiful because you can have a trademark that goes on indefinitely. So trademarks can last forever and ever. The one thing about trademarks is that you have to come back and renew them every 10 years.
Okay.
Copyrights have a lifetime of 70 years from the creation of the work, the life of the author plus 70 years. So you got quite a bit of time with the copyrights.
When you file a provisional patent and then you convert that provisional patent into a non-provisional patent, does the first year get included as part of the term? That's a question I get quite often. And or is it when the patent is actually issued that the clock starts?
Yes, we get that question too about the term of the non-provisional application. If you're claiming priority to the provisional application, that 1 year does not get included and does not knock off time off of the non-provisional application.
Okay. And then once you file the non-provisional patent, does that time start then as part of your term,
the time starts then as part of the term.
Okay. So it could end up taking... It could end up taking 2-3 years, possibly after office actions and everything else, to get patented. So then you're really left with only 17 years, let's say, of an issued patent.
Well, it could be that, but here's the nice thing that happens to you. Congress enacted a law years ago that says that we will offer patent term adjustment if the patent office delays in issuing a patent. So at various points during the examination process, we're supposed to issue either an office action or a notice of liability and conduct our processing in a timely manner. And if we fail to meet those guidelines, you get day-for-day patent term adjustment. And my office is actually the office that will calculate whether there's patent term adjustment on a particular application and whether there should be adjustments that are made on that patent.
Okay. By the way, your office, you're the director of Office of Petitions. We didn't get a chance to really hear about what you do. If you don't mind just sharing with us what you do at the patent office on a daily basis.
It's a lengthy list of the things that we cover here.
Yep.
We cover almost every year at the patent office. We will cover filing date issues. Or they have a problem with some of the drawings that they filed, and they're missing some drawings, and want to try to incorporate another application into it. They'll come to us and ask us to grant them a filing date for that particular application.
Okay.
We have some other applications or some other petitions where we're trying to accelerate applications and move them further along in the patent process. And so we have our Track 1 request, which if you pay a fee of $4,800, you can get your application advanced, and it'll move very quickly to the patent office and get through the patent office within a year, and that's a guarantee.
Okay.
We have our patent prosecution highway request, which will also cause an application to move forward very quickly. If you have another application in a foreign country that has been examined and we're using their work product where the application those claims have been indicated as being allowable in that foreign country, and we use their work product over here. We'll also deal with some of the examiner issues where there may be a question as to restriction practice or some of the practice that's occurring within the technology centers, and they'll petition us if there's a question about the practices in the technology centers. And then we'll cover anything after the patent gets through the technology centers where there might be something where a reference needs to be considered, and we have to withdraw the case from our issue before it goes out to begin the patent. And we also cover the patents after they get issued, and then we do that with maintenance fees. And one of the problems that we do see a lot is that independent inventors either don't know or they wind up forgetting about maintenance fees. And maintenance fees must be paid on every issued patent. And they're due at the 3.5-year anniversary, the 7.5-year anniversary, and the 11.5-year anniversary. And without that patent is considered to be expired, and it's unenforceable in a court of law. And what's usually unfortunate about it is that the independent inventors won't really realize it until about 2 years after the patent has expired. Hmm. And we have different standards in which we can try to reinstate a patent. If you can get to us within that 2-year time frame, You can come in under the unintentional standard, and it's fairly easy to meet that unintentional standard. And most people, if they can, get in under that standard, were able to get your patent back into a pending status.
Got it.
Whereas
if you
have to wait to after the 2-year mark, it's a lot harder to do.
Okay. I have a question. I mean, as much as you can answer this, Tony, it's from Chester. Chester writes, please inquire of the seemingly irrational maintenance fees after a patent is issued. 3 years, 5 years, increasing, decreasing maintenance fees. Why necessary? Why not one fee and forget it?
Okay. These are really set up as part of our funding process. The Patent Office is a fully fee-funded organization. We have no taxpayer dollars within the Patent Office. And the reason why we have maintenance fees is the fact that we try to keep the fees as low as we can on the initial filing. So we don't really recover our full cost of examining applications with the filing fee, the search fee, and the examination fee. And so with that discounted cost, we have to recover it somewhere, and we recover it on the back end with the maintenance fees. And the fees are due, like I said, at the 3.5-year mark, the 7.5-year mark, and the 11.5-year mark of the anniversary date of the patent. Those are just the dates that we're given because those are the dates that are in the statute. And the fees for the maintenance fees do increase, and they start out very low, and they increase over the lifetime of the patent. And the reason why they're set that way is that if you're not being very successful with the patent, you find out that there isn't such a market for the invention as you thought there might be, then you can decide whether you want to continue on, you know, funding this patent, or you can allow it to expire and spend as much money on it. Whereas those people that are very successful with their patent, then they're the people that really will help to fund and help to support the initial filing of applications.
Okay. I'm sure you get these type of questions all the time from inventors, and you being part of the USPTO has a great resource on their website, which is for inventors, resources for inventors. And I know that you're active with the team there for helping the inventors out. Maybe you can just share with us, because I know you probably hear a lot of these questions often, and you do have an FAQ area there, and a lot of the questions are answered. Maybe you could share with us where we can go for that info.
Well, the front www.uspto.gov is a wealth of information, and there are quite a few initiatives there that are listed there. But I want to start it really at the top of the web page. And if you can go over the top, on the top bar, you'll see a space that says Inventors. And under Inventors, there's quite a bit of resources there. We have something, a page just for independent inventors, a page that's patents for independent inventors, one for trademarks, scam protection, scam prevention, and then we have our Inventors Assistance Center, and that's also a group that's in my area here.
Okay.
And that's a fantastic resource to go to. You can go to the web page here, or you can even call us up, and we have people there that can assist you with some of the issues that you have.
That's great.
We also have our state resources and a pro bono and pro se section. Okay. There's also a couple of other things that are on our first webpage, and one of them is the IP awareness assessment awareness tool, and this is a great tool to look at and just assess how well you do in understanding what intellectual property is, and this ties in with actually the pro bono program. We only have one state up and running right now as far as the program goes, and that's Minnesota. We're looking to get some other states and some other cities online with the pro bono program, and that should be happening fairly soon.
And what does that mean for the independent inventor? What does the pro bono mean?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
let me try to translate the Greek.
Okay. I just got an email from Joe asking about what that is.
Okay, or should I say the Latin? Pro bono program is that may be short on resources. So if you don't have funds for an attorney, if you go to the pro bono program and you qualify for the pro bono program, then you might be able to, you can probably get an attorney that might be able to help you with your invention. Okay, prosecute the application here in the patent office. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite the patent office that is running the pro bono program. It's separate and apart from us, but we do work with them.
Okay, do you have to be in Minnesota to be able to qualify for that?
For the Minnesota program, you have to be in there, and there's some qualifications that go along with it. Your invention has to be, you're going to have to do a patent search, you're going to have to do the IP assessment tool and go through that and graduate with it. And then you're going to have to actually present your invention to a group of attorneys, and they're going to decide whether to accept it or not into the pro bono program.
Well, very interesting. I might have to get myself a P.O. box in Minnesota.
Well, there's the income qualifications, too. So, and as long as you meet the income qualifications, that would be great.
Oh, that's great that they're doing that. Okay. And from what I understand, the pro bono program is really looking to expand, and hopefully it'll be in the listener states coming up soon.
We have people out working right now trying to expand the. Like I said, I know they're in a number of cities right now talking with lawyers and patent bar groups, and they've gotten a lot of positive response. And some of the issues they are, you know, they're having to deal with, and they're working through them. And like I said, they should have some stuff up pretty soon, some other cities that are coming up pretty soon.
Okay, good stuff. Tony, when we spoke prior to the show, you made some interesting points about trade secrets. Maybe you could just touch on that a little bit, because that does occasionally come up. And listen, we're here to educate the inventors. One extra thing is something to add in our tool belt.
Right. And trade secrets are really one of the last pieces of the intellectual property puzzle. And with trade secrets, it's any information that gives you a competitive advantage that you can keep a secret.
Is it like the Coca-Cola formula?
It's like the formula for Coca-Cola or the recipe for Kentucky Fried Chicken. And those are all things that, as long as they can keep them secret, they're theirs. And so the formula for Coca-Cola, I think, has lasted for 100 years or over 100 years as a trade secret.
So
but
there's
it doesn't
no limit.
Have to be something like that. It could actually be a customer list. Or it could be information that you might have on your pricing guides as to the products that you're selling. And these are things that you really do want to keep fairly close, because you don't want your competitors to know what you're charging for everything, because that gives you a competitive advantage.
So do we have to file this? Do we file this somewhere? It's just something that we keep in our on our computer.
Well, I will tell you what they do, what they've done at Kentucky Fried Chicken and at Coca-Cola. And I think with Coca-Cola, they actually have a safe that they use where they keep their trade secret in it. And to move it from the bank that it was in back to their corporate headquarters, and they hired an armored truck to carry the trade secret formula from the bank to their corporate offices.
Okay.
So it's very prized corporate property, and you want to do as much as you can to try to protect it. You don't want to have everybody in the company knowing what the trade secret is. And so with some of these, it may be compartmentalized. And so you may only have a couple of people that know part of the trade secret and a couple of people that know the other part of the trade secret.
Okay, this seems appropriate. Vincenzo is asking a question. He's old school. Is it still the way to send yourself a post-dated envelope and keep your secret that way?
You know, I had a professor when I was in engineering school, and that was the way that he said that you keep yourself. And it wasn't until I got to law school that I realized that, you know, that's really not going to work so well.
Okay.
As being able to be a way to protect yourself as far as the invention goes. If you think of it in terms of a lawyer who's going to have to represent you, he's going to have a tough time taking an envelope and not knowing what's in the envelope and then being able to say, okay, well, this proves that the invention is there. He's going to have to open the envelope and see what's in there.
Got it. What about inventor notebooks?
notebooks are a great way to actually protect yourself. And the inventor notebook, it should be a notebook that gets stitched on the binding, so all the pages are there, they're locked tight together. Try to get one that has numbered pages and you can number it yourself. And then just record each day the things that you've done for that particular invention, and try to use just one notebook per invention. Don't try to do two or three inventions in the same notebook.
Because
what might happen is you might have to disclose the notebook in order to prove your date of invention, and then you'd be disclosing those other inventions that went along with it.
Okay. Okay. A lot of inventors get quotes from patent attorneys and patent agents for filing their applications and actually writing their applications and filing. Maybe you could just share with us, I'm not sure if you have it in front of you or if it's handy or if we can come back to it, but the maintenance fees or even where to find them. I'm sorry, the filing fees. You know, we get quoted with some attorneys for $5,000, another one for $2,500, and, you know, but at the end of the day, the filing fees are all the same, right?
Well, no, the filing fees are not all the same.
Good.
And you can
tell us.
You can get, hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get the filing information, filing fee information on our website. For a utility application for a small entity, the basic filing fee, and that go here, it's $190 the filing fee, and it is $310 for the search fee, and $125 for the examination fee. And as you can tell, I'm doing the addition right now.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
It's $625.
Okay.
Is the total cost for filing the application. That's what you'd have in fees. And that's as long as you have a basic application, total claims, and three independent claims. You don't have more than 100 pages of specification.
Okay, got it. Now, what's your take on inventors filing their own patents, whether it's their own provisional patent or the non-provisional, or trying to draw something themselves for a design patent?
It takes a lot of effort to file an application, and you really do have to take some time in preparing it. And it's not that an independent inventor can't file their own application, but what I would always like to tell them, and what I always tell them, is that they need to make sure that they do their homework before they file the application. And that means that they should probably go out and do a search of their the patents that are out there and a search of the other references that may be out there. And that way they get an idea of what it is that they can actually claim as their particular invention. Because it's those claims at the end of the application that give you the rights. That tells everybody what it is that you have a right to claim. And also, when you do that search of the prior inventions and prior patents, you get to look at what U.S. patents look like. And that gives you an idea of what the framework should be and how your application should look. You don't have to use the two-column format that we have for our patents, but at least you know what the sections are. You know that you need to have a brief description of the drawings. You know that you need to have a detailed description of the drawings. And that you need to have drawings if it's necessary to understand the invention. And you must have claims, and the claims are very important. And if you take some time and look at the claims and see how they're structured, you don't have to copy them verbatim, but you can see how they're structured, and that's how you should structure the claims in your application.
Okay, I mean, I have patents, and as much as I understand them and read them and mm-hmm. keep filing more patents, I'm not doing it myself. I mean, when you're looking at those things, it is an art. These guys and ladies who are doing patent applications, it's unbelievable the language that they use and how detailed and intricate they are. And I have to say something, Tony. You know,
okay.
I've seen inventors that I've helped bring along to, let's say, a potential licensee, when they end up trying to do a patent application themselves,
right.
The licensee, they get concerned with if it's done properly or not. And, you know, if you're looking to try to license your idea, they want to make sure that they have strong intellectual property protection. Otherwise, they might not need you, or if they start producing it, they don't want to worry about somebody infringing on that patent. So, I mean, as far, if you're an inventor and you're considering licensing a product, it's not that it's impossible. You could do it yourself, and you could do it fantastic.
The reason why I'm over here in the Office of Petitions is that we do get a lot of independent inventors that come through here. And I actually get a chance to talk with them and try and lead them in a direction where they actually can get some good advice and good service in getting their application through here. And it's usually because the reason why they're here is that something's gone pretty wrong with their application. It's abandoned because they didn't respond to an office action, or their patent has expired because they didn't pay the maintenance fees. And so at least this way they can get them some information, get them on track and get them in the right direction.
Got it. Well, like I was saying, I mean, it is possible, but it seems like, you know, you want to make sure it's strong. It's what these guys do for a living, and I'm sure they do a great job. What about the design patent? Is it something that you can just kind of draw up and submit?
Well, the design application you have to be very careful with. And the reason why I say that is that your claim, what you get as your protection is the drawing as you have presented it to us. So if your drawing isn't very good, then your protection isn't very good. And I know sometimes I hear people say, well, I'm not a great artist, but I want to use a photograph. And the photograph is okay, could be okay, but the problem is that if the device that you're using does not look like the device that's in the photograph, then you're going to have problems. And the other thing is that photographs sometimes you don't necessarily see details that you might think that you're going to see. Maybe because of shading, just the angle at which the camera's facing the article.
Understood. Okay. Well, that's interesting. And actually, for inventors to take a look at what a patent actually looks like, what would we do and how would we go about taking a look and seeing?
And go to the first page. And actually, there's a, under popular links, it's right in the middle of the page. It says patent search. And you can do a patent search and look for various patents. If you can't get the trademark resource centers, and there's one in every state, and if you go there, you can actually get a librarian, and they can actually help you with some of the searching patents and some of the nuances of getting through our website.
Okay.
There's a lot of information on our website, and sometimes it does help to have somebody just to help you with it.
Got it. One thing that we didn't touch upon is a patent search. Now, this is a really, I find that this is one of the hottest topics for me, just being very interactive with inventors, is that I find that inventors are really deep in their invention process. And what I mean by that is they have a prototype done, they have a non-provisional patent filed, they're out, you know, traveling the country, and they didn't do a simple patent search to begin with. What's your take on that?
I always like it if somebody can get that patent search done first, because that way it eliminates a lot of surprises for them and keeps them from having to spend money maybe when they don't necessarily need to do it.
Okay.
And I think sometimes you get surprised because the examiners, they search patent applications every day, and they are very good at finding patent references.
Maybe you could give us some tips, because what does it really mean to do a patent search, and how could we go about doing it utilizing USPTO.gov's website?
I think that might be a topic for a whole show just on how to patent search.
How about just some quick tips?
Quick tips. There are lots of places to go search for inventions. Mm-hmm. And the patent website or our website is a great place to start for a search. There are other search engines that are out there. And depending on what it is, you might want to be using those search engines. We have approximately 600 different databases that we have access to. And depending upon what the invention is, we'll use any or all of those databases to search for an invention. And each one has its own particular nuances as to what the search string should be for searching that database. Also, there are foreign patent offices that issue patents, and we'll go to their websites or go to their sites. So depending upon where you're at and which search engine you're at and which databases you're on will determine what kind of search strings you're going to use.
Okay, so
the one thing that you...
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, the one thing you don't want to do is don't use very generic terms, or don't use terms that are probably too specific for the invention you're searching for. Most patents, it's a legalese type language, and so you have to understand at least what the synonyms could be, or what the terms could be for the product you're looking for.
Okay, so when I do a basic search, when I come up with an idea, I just do a generic search on some of the basic search engines, on some of the search engines, and I put generic terms in for the most. Well, I put the terms in, and I change it around a little bit. Like I always say, I have a pen with a light, you know, a lighted pen with an LED lighted pen, and all these other things. And then I take a look around just on the general searches, and then I go into the USPTO.gov database, and there's a button there that says search for patents. And I click on that, and I start to put in those descriptive terms again, and I see what comes up. And I start to look at the prior art to start with, and just to see if there's something similar. And if I do find a match, I look at the claims and see if it's kind of overlapping or if I'm going to have an issue. And then what I do is I just write down the patent numbers, because actually when you're looking at them, the patents that were already issued, there's reference numbers for other patents that they had to reference in there. So it's like, it never ends. You just keep going.
That could lead you to other patents. Now, what I usually do is I have a thesaurus that I use whenever I start searching for inventions. And I'll use a thesaurus to pull out identical or similar terms, and I'll use those terms. And I will go in and I'll look at the patents, and I will look at the other references that are cited in patents that I think they're similar to the one that I'm looking for. And I'll use those as a springboard to find other patents. I'll also look at the whatever documents that are cited in that particular patent and use those other documents as a springboard to find other documents.
Okay.
And like I said, depending upon what the invention is, there's like about 600 different databases that you can use, and some of them are more specific than others. Some are very general in nature.
Got it.
And it really does depend on what the invention is.
You know what I do, Tony? I take all those patents that I may find that might be questionable, and I write the numbers down, and then I send it over to one of my patent attorneys that I work with or a patent agent, and I ask them their opinion. You know, based on these, and this is my idea descriptively, obviously confidentially, I'm going over it with them. Do you think that there's a possibility for us to get patent protection on it? What's your opinion?
Right. And that's if you're using a patent professional, you can actually ask that question, you know, what's your opinion on this, and do you think it's worthwhile filing the application? But if you're just looking for references themselves and looking to find out what the state of the art is, you can always go to the Patent and Trademark Resource Centers and have the librarians help you in constructing your search, and they can help you in getting that search done.
Okay. I know in our agenda of what we wanted to discuss tonight, one of the topics was expectations of when somebody files an application. And I know that there's that fast track experience that inventors or anybody that the office offers now. But when I put in an application today for a non-provisional application, otherwise known, because it's confusing to inventors, that's why I always say it. It's a non-provisional, otherwise known as a utility patent.
Or just a regular application. How's that?
A regular application.
All right.
What's the deal? Because one person says that they can get a patent.
Getting that first office action varies, and getting the overall examination done, it's going to vary from technology center to technology center. And what we do when we get the applications in is we do classify them as to a mechanical invention or an electrical invention or a chemical or whatever other type of invention it might be. And some of the areas are really crushed with the number of applications that are filed. We had over 500,000 applications filed last year. And we have hired a number of people to help us out, and we're working on bringing our backlog down. 35 to 36 months for getting the examination done in an application. That's getting through the examination process. But some areas are much lower than that, and they're down in the teens as far as the number of months to from filing to final decision, and then some are a little bit more than that.
Okay, so once you file, most likely there's going to be some questions that come up. I mean, I don't know how many just kind of streamline and go through, but for the most part, there may be questions that come up, and there's something called an office action that you may receive. So once you have that office action, there's a certain amount of time that we are allocated to respond to that?
Right. That office action is going to come out, and we are going to give you 3 months in which to respond, and that's called a shortened statutory period. You can get additional time, but you're going to have to pay for that additional time, and you can get an additional 3 months on top of the initial 3 months. So for a total of 6 months.
Okay. And once that's done, then there's the time that the examiner needs to review what the office action is, and then there's final notices, and then there's continued office actions, right? Just
A final decision that comes out from the examiner, and that's going to come out within 2 to 3 months after you file your response. And once you get that final notice from the examiner, whether it's going to be a positive reaction and a notice of allowability and telling you that the issue fee and the patent will be granted, or whether he's going to tell you that he doesn't believe the invention's patentable, and he's going to tell you that you're finally rejected. Now, that's not the end of the story, because you can always file a notice of appeal or file a continuation application and try to continue the process. You also have the chance to talk with the examiner. And this is probably one of the areas that may be underutilized, is the fact that you can always call up an examiner and request an interview. And it's best to do that right after you get that first office action. And you can get an idea of what it is that you need to do in order to get your application in the condition where the examiner can allow it.
Okay.
And the examiners really are motivated to try to get an allowed application. So both of you are going in the same direction, or trying to go in the same direction.
Okay. Allison from North Carolina is asking a question for you. She's asking, why do I need to even file a patent when I'm not able to defend it?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question, and I'll rephrase it a little bit.
Okay.
When you file an application, the application that's here in the patent office is not enforceable, because you haven't been granted any rights. It's only once that patent issues that you have rights, and that's when you can go to court and enforce your patent.
Okay, I guess what she's saying is she doesn't have the funds. Let's say it's issued, and what does she do then if she doesn't have the funds to enforce it or defend herself?
Well, that's a problem that comes up quite a bit, is that sometimes people don't have the money to enforce their patent, and there's possibility of finding an attorney that will take a case on a contingency fee basis. There are a number of attorneys out there that will do that. You do have to look a little bit for them. There's also, you need to find other people that are willing to go in with you in funding the litigation costs. But, those are some ideas as to how to proceed with defending the patent that you have.
Okay, what about the patent office? Does the patent office get involved?
We issue the rights, and that's as far as we go. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about trying to enforce it, then it becomes a matter for the federal courts in enforcing the patent rights.
Okay, got it. So let's go into the next topic, which is the America Invents update, if you don't mind giving us just a quick idea of what
right.
it's about and just some updates. And I know that on the USPTO.gov website, there's a very active link there. We've had Janet Gargola on our show, but I know the patent office is doing a great job keeping everybody posted on a daily basis.
Right. If you go on our website, you can find the America Invents Act microsite, and everything that is going on with America Invents Act is going to be on that website. We're posting as much information as we can about the law, as much information as we can about our process of creating new rules to enact the law or to carry out the law. And one of the things that's coming up is the microentity and microentity fees. And we cannot set the microentity fees until we actually set fees overall for everybody under our fee-setting authority under the America Invents Act. Mm-hmm. The microentity fees, once we get them in place, it'll be a 75% discount over whatever our normal fees are. So it's three-quarters of the price will be chopped off, and that'll be what you'd have to, that's what you'd have to pay. Now, in order to qualify for a microentity, you have to be a small. You have to qualify as a small entity, and what that is that a large corporation. You're just an independent inventor who's trying to file an application. You can't have filed more than four applications previously, and you have to have an income that's less than three times the median gross income in the previous year. You can't have licensed the invention to somebody who has a median gross income of three times the median gross income in a previous year as well.
Okay.
So it's fairly easy to qualify as a microentity. And like I said, the fees, the notice for proposed rulemaking will be coming out soon, and that's going to be on our website as well. And when that notice of proposed rulemaking comes, and we are really looking for comments to come in so that we have some idea what the public's opinion is, and we'll take that into consideration when we actually finally craft the final rules that come out.
Okay, so that's one of the main topics is the micro entity fees. What are some of the other points? We don't have to go, obviously it's quite detailed, but just some points of what an inventor should be aware of some of the changes.
Well, some of the changes coming up, and a lot of the details are going to be for supplemental examination and details of things that are going to be happening at our board of patents. It's going to be the Patent Trial and Appeal Board under the AIA. Mm-hmm. And so supplemental examination or any of the other trials that they're going to have at the board are not going to be things that you're going to deal with on a daily basis. And it'll be the rare person that has to go through that process. But the things that I think independent inventors are going to be looking at is really the change that's going to happen under Section 102 of the code, which determines who's going to get a patent, or I should say, determining what the art is that people will use in trying to decide patentability. What we're moving to is a first inventor to file system, which means if you're the first inventor and you have published your invention, meaning that you've made some public disclosure of it, you have 1 year in which to file your application. Otherwise, you're going to be time barred from being able to get a patent.
Okay.
So, and that's a slight change from where we're at currently. Whereas under the current rules, it's still the 1 year time bar if you publish that application. But there's not going to be this it'll be the first person that files that application.
Got it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting information there. Thank you, Tony. Is there anything else that that you'd like to go over just in general? I know that you're very, very active in the patent office and you're dealing with a lot of different areas. Is there anything, we're talking to the independent inventors out there, some final words of wisdom and some advice for us?
Yeah, if I had to say one thing to independent inventors, and I'd say it again, is do your homework. make sure that you get into the patent office. Make sure that you take a look at our website. We are here to help you. We have our Innovation Assistance Center, and they're here. You can either get through them through our website, or you can call them on the phone. And let me give you that number right now.
Oh, great.
Yep, you can call them at 1-800-PTO-9199. And I'll repeat the number again, 1-800-786-9199. And like I said, we have people that are there to assist you. They'll answer some questions for you. I mean, even if you have an application that you've completed and you have the paperwork filled out, they can't review the application for you, but they can tell you whether you've got the right papers and you've met some of the formal requirements for filing the application.
Great. So,
and that's a great state benefit.
It's a great experience to have a patent that's issued. It's exciting to have a patent pending application in and say that your product is patent pending. Just a great experience, and I know that you know some people have different opinions if they need patents or they don't need patents, and everybody's got different ways of bringing products to market or ideas to protect themselves. It's interesting, but the thing is that if you have, and this is just my opinion, obviously, but if you have an opportunity to be able to get patent protection, then you try to get it.
It's relatively cheap, and I know I say that, and I know there are a lot of people that say, well, the attorney's costing me this amount of money, and this costs that amount of money. But for the services that you get, and for the application or the patent that you would finally get, compared to other countries, our process is much less than you would get in other countries.
It's interesting, and we didn't even get into that about international patents. Are you familiar, maybe just to kind of give us some information on what it takes to actually file an international patent and how to get protection for ourselves in other countries?
Well, there are two ways to get international protection, and one is by filing through the Patent Cooperation Treaty, and what that is an application that you'd file. If you're a U.S. inventor, you'd file it here in the U.S. Patent Office. There's special forms that go along with it, special fees that go along with filing those applications. And once you get that application, you'd have 30 months in which to decide to file in a foreign country or foreign countries. That you can take and give you a little grace period in which to file in those other countries. Because like I said, it's going to cost you some money to file in those other countries, and you're going to need to have an attorney in those countries to represent you in prosecuting that application. Now, the other way to do it is that you take your application that you have here in the U.S. and you directly file it in that foreign country. And you will have to have somebody. The thing about taking it directly from the U.S. and filing it in the foreign country is that you're going to have to do that within 12 months of the U.S. filing date. Otherwise, you're going to lose your priority to the U.S. application.
Okay.
With the PCT, you can do that within 12 months of the filing date of the U.S. application. But like I said, you have 30 months then in which to file in those other countries.
Okay. And I know that for trademarks, you need an agent or a representative in another country to capture intellectual property protection of trademarks. Is that right?
Right. You need an agent in those countries to help you out in getting that trademark done. However, there are ways out of the Madrid Protocol in which to get some rights if you file in the U.S. Okay. So you might have an application that's filed in the U.S. and then being able to say that you have reserved a right in those other countries to file on your trademark in those other countries.
Understood. Okay. Any final words of wisdom for the inventors listening? They're working on their products and doing their patent searches and just kind of going through the office. What's your take on the whole invention process?
The final word would be, I know that you're working hard. I know it's difficult, but we are here and we are here to help you. And like I said, we've got some of the resources here to help you. And there are some resources out there in the public that are there. listed on our website that you might be able to get to. That's under the inventors column on our webpage.
Okay. That's fantastic. That was Anthony Knight from the United States Patent and Trademark Office, the Director of Petitions. Tony, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Brian, thank you very much for having me on your show.
It was fantastic, and thank you for all the listeners with your feedback. I appreciate it, and the questions that were coming in. Just like to take a moment and thank our sponsors for making our show happen. We have Adley Law Group, Patent Strategies, Carter DeLuca, Farrell & Fritz, Web Search Consultants, Inventors Digest Magazine, QuickPatents.com, United Inventors Association, UIAUSA.org, Inventor Chat, China to West. Thank you, everybody, for your support. Steinrich Communications, thank you very much, everybody. And have a great night. Signing off, Got Invention Radio. Take a look at our schedule coming up. We have Damon John, and we have some other guests that are on the schedule. Again, Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Have a great night from Got Invention Radio. Thank you for joining us. Good night.